Good evening and welcome to Tisky Sour at the World Transformed. We join you this evening from the latest bar in Brighton for our second episode here at Conference. Those watching on YouTube, thank you for tuning in. Everyone in the studio, thank you for coming along and thank you for queuing in the horrible weather and now for sitting on the floor feeling kind of damp. Sorry about that, but the conversation is going to be great, obviously, because I have an exceptional panel of guests today. Ash Sarkar, writer, broadcaster, most importantly, contributing editor at Navara Media. Yanis Varoufakis, who was... Yanis was finance minister of Greece in 2015 at the height of the standoff between the Syriza-led government and the EU. He left parliament that year, but re-entered parliament this year as an MP for the European Realistic Disobedience Front, a party he founded, and I assume a party you also named.
Absolutely. They can't get rid of us. We keep returning. We fall down and then we get up again. Yes, we did name a party. We used Carpe Diem as an excuse for creating a movement. And then that spawned all over Europe. We have 8 different political formations in Europe, from Denmark to Portugal, Greece, and so on. So we spread like a virus, and we intend to make the establishment as sick as we can.
That just reminded me, some of our most reactionary haters on Twitter always say, Norovirus Media are on Sky News again.
Tom Watson's alt accounts.
Yeah.
Tweet deck.
We are also joined by Aaron Bastani, co-founder of Navara Media. And author of Fully Automated Luxury Communism. For those watching at home, we have already explained to the people who are in the studio, if you were expecting Len McCluskey, General Secretary of Unite, he is not here and he did pull out at the last minute, which would normally be a reason for me to get kind of annoyed at them. But he did have a very good excuse for someone who is a leader of a trade union, which is that, unfortunately, 3,000 members of his union have their jobs at risk because Thomas Cook has just collapsed. Because I was in conference all day, watching the Brexit debate, thinking about what we're going to talk about today. That means I haven't actually done much research on what's going on with Thomas Cook. So Len McCluskey, Aaron Bastani, Len McCluskey's stand-in. Sorry, that was in my script that when I point there, I say Len McCluskey. Aaron Bastani. What happened with Thomas Cook?
Well, I didn't know this, but Thomas Cook is almost, or was almost 200 years old. So it was a very, very old and venerable British brand. And it's collapsed for a bunch of reasons. The primary one in terms of its the long-term dynamics at work is technological change, how people are traveling and taking holidays. In the short term, it couldn't access credit, about £200 million, as a bridging loan to continue. But that crisis for Thomas Cook, is that better? Good. That was a short-term problem, was liquidity. But the longer-term problem is more structural, and it pivoted around technological change.
Okay, we're going to move on to Brexit.
Well, before we do, can I
ask, yeah, go on.
Say a couple of things about Thomas Cook? Well, firstly, it's got to do with the business model. When you have Expedia and all the other sites, they do the job that Thomas Cook did with zero costs, zero fixed costs. They had no buildings, they had no aeroplanes, they had nothing. They had no capital, except like Amazon, you know, effectively shut down 60% of retail business in the Western world. That was the fate of Thomas Cook. But on a personal note, I would like to say something about Thomas Cook. You'll be surprised that I have something to say about Thomas Cook on a personal note. My grandfather got his first job in 1924, in Cairo, Egypt, as the managing director of Thomas Cook, organizing trips on the Nile by the British aristocracy. And he was there until 1961. And I discovered all these diaries very, very recently on Thomas Cook letterhead from that period. So it's a sad day for me too, personally.
I was expecting a story about an 18 to 30 holiday from back in the day.
I actually have a story about Yanis.
Oh, go on.
So this isn't the first time we've met. We actually spoke together on a panel a while ago. But before that, we met, and I don't think you can remember, because it was at the height of the crisis. You were in government, mm-hmm. and I was working in a pub called the Blue Lion on Grayson Road. And you walked in ordered a Peroni and I lost my fucking mind. I was just like, oh my God, that's either Yanis Varoufakis or a bald man who looks a lot like Yanis Varoufakis. And I kind of have to either way take the chance and talk to either Yanis Varoufakis or this bald man who looks like him. And I like sort of tried to concoct an excuse to come close to your table and like take some glasses. And I think you were talking to a journalist or something. I don't know why you were in London. And I sort of like very
I
shakily.
Was George Osborne. You know, can you please show some sympathy.
And instead, you ran into me, which is even worse somehow.
Probably the best part of the night.
I like squeaked at you. I was just like, I love your work, man. And you were like, okay, barmaid.
I never called you barmaid.
No, you didn't. You didn't. You did. You were very sweet about it, but somewhat bemused. So I think you were like, oh, there's like, you know, English barmaid is like apparently very into Greek politics.
Okay, now I know you tuned in or arrived here expecting a conversation about Labour's Brexit policy, not the living embodiment of Labour's Brexit policy, which is to change the subject. So we are going to get onto that now. So, and first of all, I'm going to fill you in as to what happened on the conference floor today, because it was fairly significant. So a quick rundown of today's events. This afternoon, two significant and contrasting motions were debated in conference. The first was proposed by Labour's National Executive Committee. That's Labour's ruling body. It reaffirmed Labour's commitment to a second referendum, but said the party would not commit to how it would campaign until after a general election, when a special conference would be held. The second was proposed by a number of CLPs and committed to immediately campaigning for Remain. This morning, there was speculation the Remain motion could pass as Unison, Britain's largest trade union, broke ranks with the party leadership, saying they would abstain on the NEC motion and vote for the motion to remain. But as a surprise to many, and perhaps to myself, the vast majority of delegates from CLPs voted for the NEC motion. When that came through, I was in the room, there was a huge chant of, oh, Jeremy Corbyn, as the NEC motion was backed. So this had clearly become an issue, which was seen as a confidence motion in Jeremy Corbyn. So as it stands, Labour is a party for a referendum, but not a party of Leave or a party of Remain. I'm slowly moving to the left here, but that's fine. I'll swing myself back.
What happened to everyone's politics?
Ash, the Labour Party, the Labour members have decided this is a legitimate decision, democratically debated, voted on. Is it still, though, does it commit Labour to further months of dithering?
So I would say that there's a positive thing and a negative thing. The positive thing is that unlike last year, the sort of meat of the disagreement wasn't hammered out in the compositing process. And just in case anyone doesn't know what the compositing process is, because I don't know, they've got a life. It's basically when similar motions on a similar theme are passed by different CLPs. And so then to make sure that, you know, you don't have a conference which is, you know, crowded out by 15 versions of roughly the same thing, you've got a process of synthesizing them into some kind of compromise. In reality, what happens is you've got the relevant CLP delegates, you've got the relevant trade union representation, and the shadow cabinet team locked in a room for hours into the night. You've got gouging of tender underbellies, you've got twisting of arms. And in particular, at conference last year, when that came to the Brexit motion, it meant that there was a lot of finicking over the precise wording. So at that time, the option of a second referendum seemed like a victory for those Remain supporting parts of the membership. What actually happened over the course of the intervening year is that the option of the second referendum was kind of like Chekhov's gun. So you don't really know when it's going to be used, but you know at some point it's going to be reached for. And with the European election results in particular, there was this sense of, you know, the tool you had at your disposal was never really, you know, grasped or, you know, opted for at the relevant time. So this year, in a way, I think the failure of the compositing process has been a really good thing, because it means that the membership itself gets to decide the direction of their party. Now, I'm currently weighing up whether or not I think that this Brexit position reaffirming a commitment to a second referendum, but not deciding what the Labour position will be until after a special conference. I'm trying to weigh up whether I think it's a good thing or a bad thing. I think it's a good thing in terms of it represents a huge journey from where the Labour leadership had been with regards to a second referendum. I think that it is a lot more concrete than the sort of, you know, at various times, if the planets align, if you have a full moon in Aries and, you know, blah, 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 you know, X, Y, Z will happen. You've got something which feels a lot more tangible. However, I wonder if there's a problem with still communicating the idea of neutrality to the electorate. Because what Corbyn and his leadership team are trying to do is keep together that electoral coalition, we've heard this a million times before, of Remainers and soft leavers. And it's only by mobilising both the Remain vote and the soft leave vote in leave voting constituencies that Labour will have the chance of securing a majority at a general election. And I wonder if what is a noble attempt, again, to depolarise, to find a democratic way through, to sort of, you know, keep making overtures to leave voters saying that Labour is a home for you and will represent in some way your most desired option, looks like dithering and kicking the can down the road. And in order to maintain consensus, what you've sacrificed is clarity. And that's something which I'm deeply worried about.
Aaron, do you worry about a lack of clarity going into this general election? I just like to add, I'm not just worried about neutrality, I'm worried about indecision. So it's not just that Labour have now come out saying, we are a party who will remain neutral and let the people decide. They are a party who said, we'll decide, but in 6 months' time. What do you think about that?
Well, there was some decisiveness around today's outcome. So the first is we'll definitely have another referendum within 6 months for Labour government. And I think for a lot of people who are Labour agnostic, but want the best possible path to remain, that's quite a significant thing. So vote for these people, within 6 months, there'll be another referendum. And the reality is the Liberal Democrats aren't going to form the next government. I did an event yesterday with Vince Cable. He was asked about the Liberal Democrats' position on Brexit and a second referendum. And he said, our position is another referendum. He didn't say revoke. And he said, but in the very unlikely event of us having a parliamentary majority, which will never happen, which he literally said this, yes, we would revoke. And within the Westminster system, it would have a mandate because you'd have won a general election, right? So the Labour position is fundamentally the same as the Liberal Democrat position on this. And I think that 6 month point probably can't be underestimated in terms of useful rhetoric in a general election. We've got a general election period, and with 6 months of us forming government, Jeremy Corbyn going into 10 Downing Street, that's a really substantial point. And I think also, in addition to that, this special conference where Labour members would hash out a policy and what the party should do in that second referendum is, again, really, really, really important. And so I'm probably a bit more optimistic about this than maybe you two, but I also agree that you do need to be decisive. You need decisive policy, but sometimes in the short term, you can mask indecisive policy with decisive rhetoric. And I think we can use that object of another referendum within 6 months of a Labour government in quite powerful ways, which we probably don't quite yet comprehend.
Yanis, we're all journalists and Labour activists who think about this every day and think about what Labour's Brexit position should be and how it's most likely to play in a general election, et cetera, et cetera. Obviously, you have been seeing this whole shit show, you could call it, from the outside. And I was wondering if, you know, distance brings with it clarity. I don't know what you have thought about the last 3 years of British politics and the internal row in the Labour Party over how to approach the Brexit issue.
I wish. There's no distance between us folks. We are in the same cauldron. We are facing exactly the same challenges. Brexit is not a British issue. It's a European issue. It's an international issue. First item of news I read about every morning in Athens before I go to Parliament to find our new Tory Greek government is Brexit stuff. From the Financial Times, the first port of call, always read the rag of the enemy. Decisiveness. It is so overrated. Look at the Lib Dems. They're very decisive. Joss Winston said, you know, we'll revoke. But now what we hear from Aaron is that their position is very much like the student fees position. If we're in opposition, we're against the trebling of student fees, but if we're in government, we will support it. Thank you. I'm not interested in that kind of decisiveness. On the issue of Brexit, I think you should be very proud of the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn. From the beginning, the media will always vilify Jeremy Corbyn on Brexit, on anything, as long as he threatens the property rights and the City of London that underpin the business model of the media. So whatever his position on Brexit is, they will find something to say about it. We shouldn't be concerned with what the media says. If you think about it, yeah, Jeremy Corbyn is somebody who, like me, we were very skeptical of the European common market in the 1970s. I opposed Greece's entry into the EEC back then, just like Tony Benn, the mentor. I think everybody's mentor. I hope he's everybody's mentor in this room. Opposed it. But at the same time, we are realists. We acknowledge that 40 years, 43 years of being inside a single market and a common market creates facts on the ground. And there is a profound difference between saying we should not have gotten in from saying we should get out. There is a difference between dynamic and static analysis in mathematics. Ignore this point. So I remember having these long discussions with John McDonnell in 2015-16 and with Jeremy and with the other comrades. And we all came to the same position that I had in Greece. Okay, I'm exceptionally critical of the European Union, but our job as socialists is to minimize harm, to minimize damage, the costs on common folk. So the EU is profoundly anti-democratic. It's a democracy-free zone. It's got many flaws, but exiting it is going to spearhead xenophobic, right-wing process, and at the same time do a lot of damage to the good people of the north of England, of the south of England, of Scotland, so on and so forth. So we had a radical Remain position. I was here because, you know, the distance you refer to is not true. I mean, I gave 16 speeches against Brexit in 16 different cities, some of them with John McDonnell. And when we were being accused of being ambivalent, ambiguous, rubbish. We were just smart and wise and nuanced. Because, you know, there's nothing ambiguous about opposition. I used to say to people in Leeds, in Doncaster, in Bristol, the European Union sucks, but we have to stay in it and to transform it from within. And when people said to me, but, you know, what grade would you give to the EU? Between 0 and 10, this is a question that was being asked generally back then, I would say 2. But I still think you should remain. And they say, how come you say you would only give 2? Not 7, 2 I gave. And still ask us to remain. I said, look, if you ask me what do I think about the Greek state between 0 and 10, I would give 0.8. But I do not believe in the disbandment of the Greek state. I believe in fixing it. So, That was a nuanced position. It was not an ambiguous position. It was not a flip-flopping position. And then after that, because we're Democrats, we realized that we lost. And we lost because the good people who were progressive and anti-establishment turned around and said to us, I remember I was with John McDonnell in Leeds in particular. There was this wonderful lady who came to me and said, after my speech, look, Yanis, I like you. And I would normally do as you say, but not on this occasion. I'm going to vote to leave because, you know what? Jeremy is not in 10 Downing Street. So who's going to clash with the EU in order to transform it? This Remain and Reform, there will be no reform. Cameron is going to take a Remain vote as a vote of confidence and nothing is going to change. And we have to respect that lady. We must, you know, treating her like vermin, who was completely usurped and misled by the Brexiteers and the establishment. So this is a very big mistake. So Jeremy's attempt to unite progressive Leavers and progressive Remain and to embed a nuanced democratic debate about Brexit within an overall project against austerity, against militarization, against all those components of the broken business model that is Britain with zero-hour contracts and all that, with the City of London. That has been a remarkably brave thing, an important thing to do. And now you can see the evolution of the Labour. The Guardian and the Telegraph and so on are portraying Jeremy Corbyn and the NEC and so on as being dragged by public opinion. Well, that's not a bad thing. It's a democratic thing to allow yourself to be dragged by public opinion, but at the same time, they are leading public opinion. And to say that, look, Boris Johnson entered 10 Downing Street by promising a hard Brexit, a destructive, right-wing, Trumpist, xenophobic hard Brexit. We're going to have a general election. The general election is going to settle the issue on hard Brexit. The only thing that can put hard Brexit off the table is a general election with a Corbyn victory. And immediately after the Corbyn victory, a responsible Labour government is going to put to the people a choice between two options, neither of which is destructive, to remain or a customs union plus. And the people of Britain will decide. Let me step off the script of the Labour Party leadership. I'll go a bit further. Things I would like to see, which I haven't seen yet. Well, firstly, I would like to see the special conference take place before he goes to Brussels, not after he goes to Brussels. Because let's face it, whatever, he's not going to negotiate with Brussels. No one negotiates with Brussels, because Brussels does not do negotiations. But if he says to them customs union, they'll say yes. If he says customs union plus single market, which means also freedom of movement, they will say yes. You folks will have to decide what he takes to Brussels. And then he comes back. So I think this is something that is very sensible to leave for after the election. After you have defeated, we have defeated Boris Johnson and hard Brexit. We have a...
I'm loaning you my mic.
Okay, thank you. But I don't want you to have mine.
No.
We'll share this one. We'll share. Shared prosperity, right? That's our motto.
Expropriation without compensation.
And the second thing that I would like to add to the Brexit process is the notion that the second referendum will not end the issue, but it will begin the issue, not of Brexit, but the issue of trusting the people, of deep democratization. I would like to see the second referendum as the beginning of a constitutional assembly process, the purpose of which is to give the British voters, citizens of this country, control of a process, the result of which will be the writing of a progressive constitution for the United Kingdom that resolves the issues about the representation of England, which doesn't have any. The Scots have their own parliament, the Welsh have their own. About Northern Ireland, joint sovereignty must be inscribed in a new constitution. The question about private schools and their abolition. I don't think that Parliament can do this. I think that this needs to be part of the constitutional process, because you need reinforced, enhanced legitimacy in order to ban private schools. I'm all in favor of banning them, but you can't depend on a House of Commons that has been elected on the basis of first past the post to do something as significant as that. And to generally open up the discussion about what kind of country you want to have. That should be the, you know, what happens after the second referendum. I've spoken far too long.
So I've got a question for both you and for Aaron, and it's about some of the big picture stuff. Because I wonder, when we talk about Leave voters who also have voted Labour and perhaps will do again, if we are willfully steering ourselves away from the question of migration and freedom of movement, because it's a very difficult conversation to have on the left, where we might share all sorts of progressive values when it comes to the economy, when it comes to closing wealth inequalities, we might share all sorts of politics, actually when it comes to our analysis of many aspects of the EU. But fundamentally, and I think this was going to be the thing which I was going to be chasing Len McCluskey around the stage with, is there is still this sense that mass migration, whether it is from the EU or from non-EU countries, is a means of undercutting the wages of British workers. And it's something which I come up against again and again when I talk to lots of Lexiters. They say, how can you believe in freedom of movement, Ash? You're meant to be an anti-racist. It's a class of privileged, mostly white migrants. How can you be in league with a capitalist plot to undercut the wages of workers here. And I know what I say to that, but ultimately, after we have that conversation, we end up further away than when we first started. Do you see what I mean? Is it possible to have that conversation with Labour leavers, or strategically, do we leave it be?
Come on, Yanis.
Come on.
You're a former finance minister. Come on. I'm 30.
No one is an expert on financial and economic matters. This is not like engineering. You can't have democracy if you think that some have more expert opinion on economics and finance than others.
But I'm
so
30,
you speak first.
I'm 30 years at best from walking into 10 Downing Street with that coat.
That's
in my future.
Unless I go there for tea.
Oh, it was number 11, wasn't it? Right. When you saw George Osborne. Sorry. My mistake. I'll be quick. So I would say that it's absolutely possible to have very high rates of immigration and have... God, this sounded terrible tonight. My apologies. I hope it's not as bad as I just made it up. I don't know, I got really... I have too much caffeine, so when you don't sleep enough, you get quite grouchy and then you drink the coffee. And it wasn't coffee, it was Club Mate.
Aaron, in his old age, gets crankier and crankier. That's what he's going to be like. You know, Grandpa sits an old man yells at sound engineer.
Yeah. Or audiovisual equipment.
It's going to grow on you.
Yeah. So what I would say is it's perfectly possible to have high rates of immigration and to have increasing wages. And you do that by having closed shop unions. You do that by having sectoral bargaining. So for instance, we have an entire sector of the economy, care work, and you have a guaranteed floor on what those workers earn. You can have very high rates of immigration and those wages won't fall. So yes, labour supply does, and Yanis, he is an exceptional economist, so he will be able to tell you more about this than I can. But labour supply is a variable on the price that workers can demand for their labour. But the reason you create trade unions and you have a repertoire of tactics like strikes, etc., is because workers can do this through collective action. So Ash is absolutely right to say that's not necessarily a thing. Look at China. In China, over the last 20 years, you've had basically 1 million workers go from the country to the city every month. And yet wages in Chinese cities have been going up. So the idea that just more workers means wages fall is a very weak understanding generally of the relationship between labour, wages and capitalist growth. So that's one thing. However, there is a deeper issue here, which is around one of the great crises of the 21st century, which is very rarely mentioned, which is care and demographic ageing. And the reality is ageing populations will require more and more people to care for them. And there will be a parasitic relationship between the global north and the global south of us needing workers from these countries to care for aging populations. It's almost a cheap input, right, to reproduce circuits of value in the global north. And the point is these same countries, slightly later, like Nigeria, like Somalia, like Tanzania, they're going to go through the exact same trends of aging populations, falling birth rates, and they'll need care workers too. So we need to understand that there is the possibility of core periphery relations, of us exploiting countries of the global south in certain ways, to sustain an economic model here, which, you know, so that needs to be in the conversation around freedom of movement and migration policies and so on. But the point that Ash has made about freedom of movement necessarily means falling wages, categorically untrue. You know, and there's very little evidence which backs it up.
Keep the mic closer to your mouth and the sound will improve.
Like that.
Like that.
It was your fault.
Eat
all
the mic.
I actually want to get your answer on that in a moment, Yanis, because I want to, you know, Labour are going to have a credible leave option. They're going to have to either negotiate that or agree that. And I think the question of freedom of movement will come up on that. Whilst the Labour Party are negotiating themselves leaving the EU, Navarra Media are going to be negotiating leaving our shipping container in Bermondsey. And upgrading, moving out of a shipping container in Bermondsey to a slightly nicer warehouse 10 minutes up the road. Slightly increases our cost, which means we have started a one-off fundraiser. We're trying to raise 15 grand in 2 weeks so that we can move to a nicer location, closer to the station. It'll be much easier for us to pull parliamentarians out of parliament, I suppose, and ask them the questions that you want asked. As ever, to support Navarra Media, please go to support.navarramedia.com and donate the equivalent of 1 hour's wage a month. We're going to go to your questions online at the end of the show. We're also going to take some questions from the audience. Yanis, it is now Labour Party policy to negotiate a leave option, a credible leave option. What should that look like?
Customs union and single market with preservation of freedom of movement. In other words, stepping out of the common agricultural policy, the fisheries agreement, the EU Council, and staying in everything else. So harm minimization, harm minimization while respecting the original will of 51.8% to leave, with a constitutional assembly process that may very well lead to the decision of this wonderful nation, or nations, I should say, to step back in a EU that has received a smack in the face by the British public. Because, you know, I fought for Remain, and I was exceptionally sad on that night when I found out that Farage had won. Gove had won. Johnson had won. But I can tell you that if you simply crash back into the EU now, there will be some very, very happy Austerian neoliberals in Brussels. And I don't want that. At the same time, I want to see harm minimization. But if the people of Britain decide to remain, that's fine, as long as we have a constitutional assembly process. But let me speak to the issue, the question about freedom of movement. And now I will speak like an economist. I hope that I will not be very economic-y. I will agree with Aaron 100%. There are two monstrous fallacies of the neoliberal right-wing establishment that we need to debunk. One is the fallacy that during a recession, we need public expenditure cuts in order to balance the books of the government. That we already have debunked. I don't think you need a repetition of the flaws of this argument. The main point is that this is an argument based on the assumption that all other things are equal. All other things are not equal. When you're cutting public expenditure during a crisis, what you're doing is you're reducing incomes. If you reduce incomes, you reduce the tax take, and then you start resembling a stupid cat chasing his own tail. The more austerity you impose, the greater the budget deficit, then more austerity, more budget deficits. You know, it's a race to the bottom. Similarly, the second fallacy is this fallacy, the fallacy that to think that if migrants come in, if the borders are torn down and the migrants come in, they will drive, you know, the labor supply will go up. Supply goes up, down, price comes down. That, again, is predicated upon the assumption that all other things will be equal. Well, all other things will not be equal. The migrants bring with them tremendous human capital, skills. They do jobs that nobody else would do. So average incomes rise. And therefore, it's not a situation where the same pie is being divided amongst more people. And we know that. Well, look, Greece is proof of both fallacies. Firstly, you had the harshest austerity in the universe. And the result was a constantly increasing debt-to-GDP ratio. So we've proven that theorem, that austerity never works. And we've proven the second theorem, that labor supply is not the issue. Now, since the crisis began, we lost 10% of the population to migration, the opposite problem to what supposedly you have. So 10% of the population left. What happened to wages? According to this theory, the labor supply shrunk, so wages should go up. Well, wages collapsed by 44%. So you see, we've proven both fallacies wrong. You mentioned the problem of democratics. I'll mention another problem. I remember I was in Doncaster, and there was this, again, wonderful woman. It's old ladies impart immense nuggets of wisdom to me when I go to the north of England. I don't know why that happens.
My grandma's going to be so happy when she hears you say
there
that.
There you are. So she said to me, you know, look, Yanis, I'm not racist. I'm a socialist. I've been trade unionist of my life, an 80-year-old woman. But you know what? You've got to acknowledge there is a problem with all this unchecked migration. I said, what is the problem? She said, look, the building I live in, you know, there is this flat next to mine, my next door flat. And there are four Romanian boys living there. And they are sharing. They have jobs, you know, badly paid jobs, but there are four of them. And they were lovely boys, and I really like them. And they look after me, and I cook for them. And, you know, they're wonderful young men. But the fact of the matter is, because there are four of them, they have four wages, they can outbid a local family. when it comes to rents. And most of their money goes to their mothers and fathers, which is fantastic because it's good to have young people caring for their parents. And they send, but they send the money out. The money leaves Doncaster. It goes to Romania. And then I asked her, I said, tell me about the history of that building. And it turns out that it used to be a block of council flats that had been privatized. So I said to her, look, the problem therefore is not the young Romanians living there. The problem is that this block of flats was privatized. So the problem is austerity and Thatcherism. It's not the Romanian boys. If you had more social housing, not less, the Romanian boys would be, you know, living in private accommodation. They would be able to afford it, as they do now, because this has been privatized. And they would be boosting the economy, even if they are sending money back home. So this is what we really must do. We must, you know, deconstruct the toxic neoliberal austerian arguments, and we must not allow the left to fall prey to a right-wing xenophobic agenda which is trying to co-opt working-class people to the interests of either capital accumulation or the fascists. This is what happened in the 1920s and 1930s. We must not allow it to happen in our midst.
So obviously I agree with both of you, but I'm really, really not an economist. Like I'm the opposite of an economist.
What's the opposite of an economist?
An English lit graduate. Someone who still has to use an abacus to add up, my friend. And while I agree with you, I guess what I'm trying to say is that I think that lots of the things that are driving the immigration discussion don't just have their origins in economic immiseration. And I think it's something which is a lot older. And I think it's something which is about how in the British political imagination, the presence of migrants itself is interpreted as a sign of national decline. And I think you sort of see that with Enoch Powell's Rivers of Blood speech, and then sort of it gets, you know, retrenched and repeated over and over again. And I think that in the some of the conversations that I've had where we've reached that place of shared economic understanding about, yes, the problem is privatization. The problem is, you know, that your jobs were outsourced, that they were automated. The problem is that you're now on, like, you know, a shitty contract. We can reach that shared place of economic understanding, and still it comes down to, why are these people here? Changing the way my community looks. I don't like it. And in particular, and this was how, you know, the Leave campaign used potent images, the slippage between anxieties around EU migration as a way of non-EU migrants making it to this country. And I guess my question comes back down to a question of strategy, which is, to what extent should the left engage those cultural questions, those questions about, you know, political imagination, the way in which we conceive of the body politic, in order to put together that progressive coalition of soft leavers and remainers that will deliver a socialist government?
I have some thoughts, but Yanis, you want to reply? So I think we're getting Paul Mason on tomorrow, right? I believe. And he's written a great new book. As often with Paul, there's some things to disagree with, but there's often lots of very powerful provocations and lots of really useful ideas. And one of the things he talks about in his new book, Clear Bright Future, is this idea of the disintegration of the neoliberal self. And we need to understand that certain forms of selfhood really came out of the neoliberal counter-revolution. And that's how we need to understand the last 45 years. The first 70, 65 years, the 20th century, were revolutionary. Democratic suffrage, women's rights, gay rights, anti-colonialism, the welfare state, unimaginable in 1900, common sense by 1965. And all of that had to be systematically decimated by, generally speaking, a coalition of the far right and the centre right. And that's what we're seeing in Boris Johnson. Which camp does he really fall in? Doesn't really matter. He's a convergence of the two. And that counter-revolution wasn't just in sights of political economy and geopolitics, but it also fostered new kinds of selfhood. Margaret Thatcher said, economics is the means, the point is to change the soul. And so partly, Ash is right, these are very ancient forms of racism. And in a certain sense, they grow out of the specificities of Britain and its empire. But I also think we have to recognise that this counter-revolution created new forms of social and individual psychology. And Paul puts it very well, one of his very, you know, powerful little vignettes. He'll say, in your local town or city, wherever you're from, that neoliberal selfhood, when asked, we're going to build the library in your town, it wouldn't say, oh, great, what books will it have? It will say, how much money will it make? What's the return on investment? And what that means is you have no ordering principles, no higher values in society. And so I'm a materialist, right? And I think fundamentally you need to appeal to the working class's material interests, and often it works. However, Ashley is definitely right to talk about the point also to appeal to values. And so when somebody says, well, you know, you see this also, by the way, with young people. What's really interesting, I think, with the sort of far right, this by and large, a geriatric far right, an older far right, and I'll talk about why that, again, is a materialist understanding of what's going on. Look, older voters, baby boomers in particular.
Radicalised pensioners.
Although the oldest old voted Remain, which is incredibly interesting, actually, because they tended to remember the experience of the Second World War. It's not just a hatred of immigrants or non-whites, it's also the young. And I've often seen this in the street, you know. You see older people, and they hate young people, groups of young people walking around, as if their presence is really abusing them. And here's an interesting statistic. In 1968, the average age of a football fan in the Stretford End, at Old Trafford and Manchester United, the average age was 17 years old. 17 years old. Today it's about 40. And the point is, young people now can't even participate in the forms of social and sort of communal participation that were the norm 40 years ago, at the high point of that 20th century revolution. They're locked out from those kinds of participation. And so I think that neoliberal self, how dare you walk on the street in front of me, a group, a rabble of young people just existing, how disgusting. It's a very different mindset to the norm of the 1960s. You would have been a football terrorist and there would have been young people getting on. And they'd start families in their early 20s, they'd buy houses, etc. A very different relationship between middle-aged people and the young. And so I think we have to have obviously a materialist understanding of what's going on, but also understand some very disturbed, broken forms of self-knowledge and understanding of other people also grew out of this counter-revolution. And it's very sad. Now, sometimes you have to just write somebody off. You go, look, I haven't got the energy today to deal with this person, and my energy is better used trying to persuade somebody else. But at the same time, I think it is a powerful thing to say, what do you believe in? Why are we here? What's the point of living in a society? Because I think a lot of that just comes out of an ethical and social vacuum. And so I think there's importance here in appealing to higher values, higher ethics of what makes life interesting. Let's be real, it's other people. It's a very powerful thing. This, you know, we're happiest when we're with friends and family and with other people. And I think that neoliberal subjectivity can be smashed through the liminality of spaces like this. Liminality, by the way, sorry, this is PhDs. Liminality is where you go into spaces where you can challenge, undermine, question assumptions about who you are and who other people are. And I think we need to create more of these spaces in society. Squats are the classic example. But generally speaking, they have massively constricted in recent decades. And I think if we do that on mass scale, actually a lot of these people who have these presumptions about how disgusting young people are, how disgusting black people are, we have more of these spaces for shared togetherness. I sound very hippy-dippy here. But that's part of the project with a mass party. If you have 1 million members and you've got local socialist clubs, you party together, people have drinks together, cinema clubs, whatever, that sense of togetherness gradually will make people question their assumptions. Very, very powerful. So it's not just material interests that matter, but psychology and emotions too.
I like you in this mode. It's like Marx retired and Marx retired and moved to Goa and sort of like got very much in touch with their emotions and plays lots of volleyball. It's a path my uncle took, actually, although I suppose he didn't have the Marx phase at the beginning. I've forgotten what we were asking you now.
Well,
racism.
Oh, and actually, I suppose this is a very relevant thing to ask you, because I suppose the Labour Party and the British left often says, oh, we're in such a difficult situation because we want to appeal to the population, but there's also some resentment towards mass migration. And people say that the migrant or the so-called migrant crisis was one of the reasons that Leave won, because it was a more politicised issue at that time. Obviously, Greece, Syriza came into power at the height of that humanitarian crisis, which was the Syrian civil war and people fleeing to Europe. And you were on the front line of that. And that, to me, it didn't seem like, you know, tensions that arose out of that were economic tensions. They seemed to be cultural tensions about, you know, people thinking they were being invaded. And I don't know how, when you were in government or having you know, witnessed politics in Greece since then, how you think, or what we can learn from that experience and how it was dealt with by the left in Greece?
On a historical point, I resigned a week before the influx of Syrian refugees happened. So I wasn't in government in itself, but I witnessed, of course, from very close quarters what happened. And it was really very interesting because, you know, we had a fallen nation. We had a defeated people after years of austerity and pain. We had just been crushed by a coup d'etat, effectively, to which, you know, our government participated, unfortunately. My great fear at the time was that already we had the Nazi party in parliament. The third largest party in parliament was a Nazi party, Golden Dawn. And I thought, my goodness, this will be, you know, butter to their bread. It will be, you know, a gift to the Nazis. And the opposite happened. What happened was an outpouring of solidarity to, you know, we had about 800,000 people who came in. They all left the country, only about 80,000 stayed. But they went through. And, of course, there was some animosity, divisions within the Greek community, but an overwhelming, show of solidarity. So it's not easy to predict the effect. And also it depends on the... On the historical moment, on the texture of the moment. So in places like North England, you have had, 30 years of deindustrialization and a sense of being treated like cattle whose price has fallen through the floor. Yeah, effectively. And an abandonment from all sides of politics, and from London, and from the south of England, and so on and so forth. So scapegoating becomes much easier. And let's face it, you were unlucky in the sense that your fascists were not murderers. We were lucky that our fascists were murderers. So they actually killed people, which was not good PR for them. So, you know, if Golden Dawn had fresh faces and they spoke kindly while saying, you know, in politely, not kindly, then it would have been a very different business in Greece. So the nuances of politics really matters. But allow me to come to your point, Ash. There's no doubt that the value system of people in those communities is crucial. It's not a question of just, you know, ending universal credit, investing more in, you know, public services, social housing. You have to take seriously the cultural milieu. There's no doubt about that. But I'm going to be very, you know, sort of, let's say provocative on this, but I genuinely believe this. Xenophobia light is the worst antidote to xenophobia heavy. You cannot compete with the xenophobes by saying, we allow 20,000 people in the country. Maybe we should make this 100,000. This is simply, you know, effectively you're on a slippery slope. The only way you can change those values is by shocking them through radical humanism, saying to them, look, folks, we believe in doing away with borders completely. And they say, what? Doing away with borders? Yeah, because we're all Africans. We're, you know, humanity sprang out of Africa. Everybody came to this island from Africa.
This is getting a really hippie retreat in Ghana now, isn't it?
and we are all bastards. You know, by definition, anthropologically speaking, we are all bastards. We originated in Africa. So, you know, we lost our pigmentation. That's a great
Some
loss.
Of us didn't.
Some of you didn't, because you came later. Yeah, that's all. Allow me to share a personal story now. When I first moved to England, this was 1978, which reveals my age, Greece was not in the European Economic Community, so I was an alien, as if I was, you know, Chinese or whatever. We didn't count as Europe. And therefore, I had to go through the whole process of every time I arrived in Britain, having to be checked thoroughly, interrogated, even though I lived here, even had, at some point, I had a work permit. which I was carrying with me. I even had a police registration certificate. I had to go and register and be fingerprinted at the local police station in Colchester, Essex. So, you know, and I remember how I hated every time I arrived in Heathrow, visiting my family, I would come back. And I would get the same question. I mean, I was a permanent resident. I had the work permit. And they would say, sir, how long are you staying for? When are you leaving? So this was a kind of soft harassment. And I found the antidote to that. Do you know what it was? I would smile and say, as long as I have to, not a second longer. And suddenly the same immigration officer who was trying to push me away from Britain would say, what's wrong with my country? Why don't you want to be here? So confronting them and shocking them is, you know, and using humor and humanity, radical humanism, is the only way of changing the value system of those who have been lured into xenophobia.
Ash, I feel like you might have a point building up and then I'm going to go to some audience questions.
Yeah, I mean, I believe in the antidote being radical humanism, and I also...
Take Yanis's mic.
Sorry, switch. Yep. I believe in radical humanism. I also believe in the power of humour. That's why I act like a damn fool all the fucking time. But I think maybe where I don't buy your argument is that when the harassment is light, yes, you can respond verbally and and expect that your performance of your own humanity will be enough for that humanity to be recognized. Whereas if you are a person of color and the door is being shut in your face day after day, you can't even get a job interview. You can't rent a flat. You are being stopped and searched, if you're especially a young working class black kid, by police again and again. You make a joke to those cops, might not end up that they laugh along with you. Let's just say that. So what I'm saying is that the shock value for me isn't just about an interpersonal shock value. It's the shock value of building political projects with demands which take aim at how institutions work. And yes, that goes along with humor. I'm a great believer in it. However, if one of my black friends was to hear someone say, oh, well, you know, we're all from Africa, really, they would probably say, yes, but only some of us were enslaved. And only some of us are harassed by police on our estate in the place where we live every day. We're all from Africa, but how come I don't know where I'm from? How come I don't know even what my family name is? And so I'm not trying to say that these things are insurmountable, because I'm not what you would call a racial pessimist. I think these things are possible, and I think the creation of spaces like this are how you do it. However, I just don't expect racists to recognize my humanity when the nature of racism from the start is that I am other than human.
Can I say...
I actually want to go to audience questions unless... Okay.
And it, you know, it took me 3 decades to work out, with my father in particular, the survival and the coping mechanisms of BAME people who came to this country are remarkable. So my dad's obsessed with football. He's obsessed with it. And I thought it was just a thing. He loves football. And as I got older, I realised it was a coping mechanism for him to ingratiate himself with white people.
Really? Because mine was ketamine.
But yours is probably a bit less healthy. And I realised this on 2 occasions. First, I was getting a haircut, and obviously nobody was talking to him. It's just for these white barbers, this odd brown guy. And he says, oh, who's your team? The guy goes, Southampton. My dad goes, Mick Shannon, FA Cup final, fantastic goal. 1971 or whatever. He goes, oh, you're a legend, mate. I was like, wow, he worked out this little hack. And so again, for people who aren't from those backgrounds, I think of myself as British, I'm mixed heritage, and because of the way I talk, I'm received in a different way to my dad, even though we look the same. I think we really need to respect the amount of work that goes into these kinds of daily interactions with these people. And yeah, it can be effective. What he does is really effective. Once he had a racist come into his taxi, being really rude, and my dad says, who's your team? He goes, West Ham. He said, 3 players have scored hat-tricks for West Ham in the Premier League era. Who are they? The guy ended up giving him a 10 quid tip. Right? By the way, it's Kevin Nolan, Paul Kitson, and Marlon Harewood. That's a really good pub quiz question. Yeah. No, so, and that's great, and people can do that, but we shouldn't expect that labour to fall on to BAME people. We need collective action forms of solidarity with white people, like Ash says, to dismantle institutional racism.
One quick point.
Oh, very quick, because we're going to go to questions.
Definitely be very quick. Look, I bow to every word you said.
But we all do.
We all do. But I don't see why that counters my point that when you have value-based xenophobia, you have to confront it head on. We agree entirely on this. But, you know, adopting a policy of restricting freedom of movement is not going to help defeat the whole phenomenon that you described.
Diversity of tactics, comrade.
Yeah.
Now, that was a quick point. Okay. This is from Liz Hall, who is watching on YouTube. What do the panel think of the Left campaign? And I've forgotten what that stands for, but it's the Lexit campaign, fundamentally. Remain means no Corbyn manifesto. There won't be time to reform, even if it was possible. I'm just going to stick to the question, because I got confused at the bit that follows it. Lexit, is it dead?
It's not dead, unfortunately. It should be.
Okay, so why should... Because you've said Labour should negotiate a deal. I suppose the deal that you're saying Labour should negotiate, is that Lexit? If we leave on that, is that Lexit or is that something else?
Before we talk about the deal, the left-wing criticism of the European Union is entirely legitimate. But you need a leap of the imagination to go from criticizing the EU to the conclusion that we should disband the EU. Because disbandment of the EU is going to unleash demonic forces of deflation, recession, unemployment that will feed the serpent's egg, or actually, you know, the serpent, and the serpent would then lay lots of eggs, which will then hatch. My metaphor is running away from it.
So okay. An economist and not a zoologist.
That's correct. I have no idea of how the natural world works. So my criticism of Lexiteers is that they are confusing a valid criticism for a policy. We should not try to disband the EU. We should try to reform it by clashing with its establishment from within. This is why I was supporting Remain in 2016. If I am now reluctant to go out all guns blazing in favor of Remain and against a Norway Plus agreement, it is because I want to respect those who disagreed with me and voted for Lexit even, you know, and also not to go from crashing out to crashing in a way that effectively makes David Cameron and Tony Blair very happy.
I mean, look, you know what I think about Lexit.
Okay, let's go to a different question then.
No, that's... Come on, Ash. Yanis gave a really, you know, it's a big question.
It's a big question. Okay, so here's the thing about Lexit is that I'm a big fan of Marx, and one of the lines I go back to again and again is it is men who make history, but not in conditions of their choosing. And so I look at the conditions which are not of our choosing. Was the Leave campaign a result of progressive social forces? No, it wasn't. Do we have a socialist government in charge of shaping the Brexit agenda, both in terms of the institutional arrangements and the political culture here? No, we do not. So the question for me is always, Boris Johnson is the Prime Minister. Girl, how are you going to get a fucking Lexit?
No, but the point is this would be after a general election anyway, so that's a bit of a cop-out because we would have a Labour government at that point.
You would win a general election mostly because you have mobilised Remainers.
Well, that's an open question, isn't it?
Which is no, but that's a fact. That is a fact. The easiest way to check to see if someone had voted Leave or Remain in 2016 was whether or not they voted Conservative or Labour in 2015. That was the sort of, you know, easiest demographic identifier. So you're going to have to win because you've mobilised Remain voters along with soft leavers, and you're going to interpret that as a mandate for a slash and burn exit from the EU. Like, I'm confused. That's all I'm saying.
How confused are you, Aaron?
In a word, by the way, you want pithy answers? Yes, it's dead. Yes. Why? And this is from somebody who's a Eurosceptic. Firstly, it would have been possible in 2016 for Britain to leave, to stay in the single market, to actually more or less do what Labour may eventually oversee. And that would be a perfectly powerful thing for us on the left. It would have been an act of solidarity with Greece, etc. However, when you start talking about leaving the European Convention on Human Rights, the European Courts of Justice, leaving the single market, ending freedom of movement, that's not the same thing. And so what I would say is to those who say, well, you know, we should fight for Lexit, a few things. Firstly, the terrain has changed. Brexit now means leaving these institutions. Can that possibly be left-wing? Under no conditions whatsoever, right? Secondly, we live in a system defined by hegemonic power blocks: Europe, America, China. Donald Trump is in the White House. If we leave the European Union and the single market, which feeds into the first point, we necessarily enter America's sphere of influence. You're living in a fantasy world if you think somehow Britain can subsist through import substitution, economic autarky.
Forget New Zealand.
Well, that's true. That's true. Apart from Kiwi lamb, you know, it's just not plausible. So on a few counts, Lex is absolutely dead. That's not to say they don't have a very powerful critique of the European Union, as Yanis has said, and maybe the European Union isn't reformable. We don't know. But I think there's a really great book on this by Enzo Traverso. He says, yes, you know, the European Union absolutely embodies certain features which we should consider as post-democratic, anti-democratic, embodies a state of exception, almost a form of post-fascism. He explicitly says this. But the fragmentation of the European Union, like this, under these conditions, presents us with a choice of post-democracy or neo-fascism. And as somebody on the left, I know what I would prefer to work within. That's where I agree with both Ash and Yanis.
We're going to now do a question each. Piffy answers. They don't have to be that piffy, but piffy-ish. Frostbite85. How do we go about... This is for you, Ash. How do we go about repairing the coalition between social democrats and liberals that made post-war liberal democracy so successful? It's a leading question, but an interesting one.
I don't know how good I am at talking to liberals. I'm not sure if I'm the best person to answer this question.
Okay, does anyone else want to take
it? Yanis. I won't say anything. Yanis.
I'm very happy to take this. Well, the liberals don't exist.
Ooh.
They've committed suicide the moment they empowered David Cameron and George Osborne.
No, but this
and
is not just only liberal Democrats. I think this is liberals in general, as a group of people, as a value system.
What does that? Well, but it's impossible to define liberals. If you are talking about the Liberal Party or the Liberal Democratic Party, we can talk about it. Yeah, and they don't exist anymore. They are completely insignificant. They also declared themselves not to be Democrats because they decided to revoke Article 50 without a referendum. So they've made themselves both contemptuous and irrelevant. As for liberals, I'm a liberal. You know, Marx was a liberal. The greatest liberal to have walked the planet Earth was Karl Marx, who set out a fantastic project of emancipating humanity, of liberating humanity. The left began in the 19th century as a movement for freeing people. And the beauty of Das Kapital, for instance, was the way in which he described so eloquently, epically, I would say, the way in which capitalism enslaves humanity. And by humanity, he didn't mean the working class only. There is this wonderful passage in which he describes the way in which the marketplace terrorizes capitalists, because competition forces them to destroy their own souls by exploiting workers, because if they don't exploit workers, others will exploit workers, and then they will face bankruptcy and the prospect of becoming proletarians. And this is done with affection for the plight of the capitalists. And so the left was always about liberation, about freedom. We lost the plot when we switched from the pursuit of liberty to the pursuit of equality. Because, you know, Marx was absolutely contemptuous of the idea of equality. Absolutely contemptuous. Remember what he was saying to Citizen Weston in the First International? He was saying, equality of bloody what? Didn't use the word bloody, but that, you know, he could have done. Equality of what? You know, income? Well, what happens if I'm disabled and you're not? In order to have equal life prospects. Whatever you define equality of, you end up with a kind of paradox. So the whole point is, if you want equality, we should all be equally free of fear, of want, of disease, of not knowing what we're going to do with our kids, education, and so on, and, you know, greening the environment and so on and so forth. So we, the left, the Marxist left, are the only liberals I recognize.
Can I add to that? I know it's not quite, I'll try my best. So when I was actually talking to three self-described liberals yesterday, and they said, what do you think of liberalism? And I said, I think a proper liberal is a socialist. And here's why. Because I think that each individual is uniquely placed to determine how they live their life. You think that too. So did J.S. Mill. But it means absolutely nothing unless you have access to the resources to determine what kind of life you want to live. I think each person should be free to do what they want. Well, if this person can access education and healthcare and housing and information and transport, but this person can't, that person's not free. And so I think Yanis is absolutely right. You need to talk about liberty. And so we can talk about liberal ends, for sure. But liberal ends can't happen with liberal means. Liberal ends of self-emancipation and self-realization can only come about with socialist means, through universal access to certain goods, which we all need to live the kinds of lives that we uniquely are allowed to author. So I don't see that as a duality there necessarily. And what I'd add finally is that liberals today adhere to a certain economic orthodoxy, which makes completely impossible the social ends they claim to so, you know, powerfully desire. And at the same time, actually, the economic orthodoxy they're obsessed with upholding is disintegrating any possibility of social liberal societies. So Yanis is right. We're two sides of the same coin. That said, most people who today who identify as liberals, liberal Democrats, are a waste of time. They're Tories.
Will Labour be able to win? Will Labour be able to win a general election with that attitude towards people who identify as
Maybe, maybe not, but I'm giving you an honest answer. Joe Swinson is how
We're not talking about Joe Swinson, though. The people who identify as liberals in society, you know.
But that's the
as
thing.
As a coalition. That is,
and that's, I think that we've interpreted the question in two different ways. So I did a talk alongside Christopher Snowden from the Institute of Economic Affairs. So, you know, real neoliberal fundamentalist, one of those people who thinks that everything is slavery apart from actual slavery, you know? And one of the things that I opened my talk with is saying, well, you and I believe in the same thing, which is the maximization of individual liberty. And I think you can only do that through collective means. I also said, and it was an audience of Tories, that if they were serious about saving capitalism, they would vote for Jeremy Corbyn. But the reason why those comments work as provocations is because you are working against how people understand those words. And so then you have to start thinking about liberals not as those who hold liberal values and want to pursue liberal ends. We're talking about people who see themselves as holding socially progressive views, have a degree of what they would identify as economic pragmatism, even if we realise that that's a load of fraff, and also define themselves by being bulwarks against populism. And this is where Jo Swinson is so important. Her loathing for Corbyn is not merely a tactical loathing, which is knowing that she needs to hoover up those sweet, sweet Tory remainers. It's a real loathing because she sees him and she sees his party as having been taken over by entryists, even though the Labour Party's internal democratic mechanisms are less democratic than the Liberal Democrats' internal democratic mechanisms. She sees fundamentally the movement of 500,000 people, which constitutes the Labour movement, as immoderate, as angry, as hectoring, unreasonable, hateful. And those are the people who now define themselves as liberals. So how you enter a conversation on that emotional terrain, well, one of the things that I would emphasise is, well, if you want a pathway to remain, here's Jeremy Corbyn. Yeah. If you want to reduce economic and wealth inequality, here's Jeremy Corbyn. If you want a progressive migration agenda, here's Jeremy Corbyn, Diane Abbott, and a movement that's fighting for it. But if all you want to do is wear an EU beret, and when we fall off the cliff edge of a no-deal Brexit, say, I was right, vote for Jo Swinson.
Okay, let's take a couple of questions from in the room here. And probably because we don't have a roaming mic, I'll have to repeat them, so keep them quick. And also I'm being told at the back to keep the whole show kind of quick at this point. So please keep your questions quick. So
none of that more of a comment than a question. If you do that, you've got to bring a tenor to the front of the stage.
Go for it, yeah. So just to repeat that for people watching at home, Labour win the election. There is a second referendum. Remain win. Labour or whoever was camping, the left campaign for Remain, be that the Labour Party or otherwise, has campaigned on a position to remain and transform or remain and reform. How do they do that? What's the plan for the first 100 days?
I think you've had some experience with the EU. Yeah. You should answer this one.
The only thing that Berlin understands is veto. What I would recommend, and what I will recommend to Jeremy, is veto the hell out of them until and unless they commit to 600 billion euros every year on the green transition that Europe needs to be financed collectively, or jointly, I should say, by the European Investment Bank, which you know, belongs to all member states, including Britain, so far. The National Investment Bank that John McDonnell speaks of and announced even today, by means of bonds that will be issued on behalf of all Europeans and supported by the European Central Bank as well as the Bank of England. And to say that unless you agree on this, because this is what climate needs, society needs to create good quality green jobs, then in every European Union Council, I'm going to veto everything.
I like that hardball. Any more questions? Yeah, especially if there's any women with questions as well, I'll prioritize.
Ladies, come on, don't leave me hanging.
Gender balance.
But yeah, what's your question?
There's loads of hands.
Yeah, so to repeat that for people watching, the question was about people who voted Leave and their concern about migration is a concern about the total population of the UK. I don't know if you've got an answer to that.
Oh, so I think you've got to do a few things. I think one, the economy is not like a bucket, right? It is not of a fixed size of which people put in and people take out. And then the more people you have taken out, the less you've got in your bucket. The economy is something which grows, and it also grows by having more economically active people participating in it. So migrants who come here, they're not just sort of, you know, parasites on the teat of housing provision and, you know, the NHS and blah, 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 which is sort of the fundamental economic understanding here, and it's a political understanding, which has its origins in very right-wing ideology, which the idea of useless eaters taking up space, taking up resources. The presence of more people also leads to the generation of more stuff, right? And so then you have to have a conversation about the organization of the economy. And these resources, what are they for? Are houses commodities, right? Are houses homes for capital? Are they a means through which, through the accumulation of debts, you sort of inflate the value of your asset and that's the security you have for when you retire? Or are they homes for people? And will there be a project of real social housing building, housing provision that's council-backed, that's affordable with rent caps, which is going to make sure that everyone who needs a home, regardless of where they're from, is going to get one? And then you come up with some of the cultural arguments, right, of who got here first. And you've got to ask people to prioritize. So how much do you like racism, right? Do you like racism so much that you would prefer there to be fewer council houses overall because you'll vote for a right-wing government which isn't going to build them, which isn't going to keep them affordable, but will keep those brown folk out, right? Is racism like Pringles? You just keep stuffing them in, can never get enough. Or do you make a compromise? Maybe yes, the presence of migrants makes you feel uncomfortable. Maybe yes, you get freaked out every time you see a Turkish greengrocer selling vegetables cheaper and better than Tesco. I don't know. I don't know how you feel. But this government is also going to provide all those services that you feel anxious about. So make a decision, and the decision is yours. That's how, I mean, maybe I'd be too combative on the doorstep. Maybe that's why they don't send me to Mansfield.
If I just can add something to this. If you look at the countries where, take Lithuania, yeah, where half of the population left as a result of the economic crisis, half of the population actually upped stamps and left. Has that decreased xenophobia or increased it? It has increased it, even though there's a lot more space now. There are empty houses because people have actually abandoned the place. So you cannot appease racists by reducing numbers.
Okay, one, I'm going
to... very quick.
What you can do is, if you're really smart, you can link it into an answer to the next question.
I've got two-word answer.
Okay, two words.
Golf courses. In England, 2% of the land is used for golf courses. Guess how much is given over to housing in England? 2%. So, that's true. It's also, it's helpful advice to being true.
I love it.
Yeah. Okay, that was worth it. I'm glad you said that.
Those were two good words.
I think... Just one, Dahlia, there's just I think this will be our last question because it's coming up to 9:30. So that's going to be the final question for the whole panel. So everyone's going to get a chance to answer that. If you've got any final points, you can link them into that. And for people on YouTube, that was a question about reforming the EU, not just in terms of how it deals with the populations of its member states, but its relation in the world. So how do you transform the way that it deals with the global south, migration, trade, etc.? So who wants to go first?
There's one thing which I feel really, really strongly about in terms of how the EU functions and the relationship between its approach to international development and how it's twinned with the project of Fortress Europe. And it's the tying of aid packages to deportation targets and legal arrangements to facilitate deportations. Now, this was an aid deal which was for Afghanistan, and the condition of it was essentially Afghanistan had to accept failed asylum seekers who are being deported. And I think that this is something which a Corbyn-led government should spearhead, particularly because of his history in the anti-war movement, the fact that he is a dedicated anti-imperialist, that Britain's international development strategy will be changed drastically, rather than pursuing just sort of giving aid money to, finance the most corrupt and parasitic capitalists that developing countries have to offer, is actually putting it into develop and strengthen their working class organization, and just getting rid of this completely ghoulish system by which, in order to pledge money to fix countries that we helped bomb into destruction, they will have to accept the refugees who are fleeing that very destruction. For me, that's a very simple point that needs to be made and something that a Corbyn-led government must pursue.
You sure? So I guess I'd have three policies. The first would be to end the Dublin Agreement in regards to the first country that non-European migrants come to. They have to stay there and seek asylum there. We have to end that because it's not working. And we need to show European solidarity and actually have a more egalitarian distribution of displaced people. And they can live in places which aren't just Greece, Malta, Italy, etc., or Central and Eastern Europe. That's the first one. The second is we need to renew what was called Operation Mare Nostrum, which was being run by the Italian state for about a year. It was an extensive search and rescue operation across the Mediterranean. It was closed for a far more limited effort, which is only about 7 miles around the Italian coast, to get people who are coming from boats from North Africa. So I'd restore Operation Mare Nostrum. Then the third thing is we also need to extend a Green New Deal, not just on a pan-European level, but also to North Africa and also to the Middle East. And this will do a couple of things. It helps them address climate change. It helps them deal with declining crop yields. It creates jobs. It creates investment. It helps foment increased levels of social solidarity and social cohesion. And obviously in places like Libya, massive amounts of FDI, foreign direct investment, going in to help a Green New Deal will be very, very helpful. And so people may want to stay there, because rather than spending money on destroying these countries with bombs, we're using our money instead to build solar cells and wind farms. Just a thought. So I think those are three really coherent policies. I think Yanis' suggestion about vetoing everything unless we have a Green New Deal at a European level, a great policy. And I think those are three ideas that a Labour government could also pursue. And it's now really incumbent on us as members. And look at the stuff we're getting through at conference every year. It's crazy. This is the stuff that we can get through at conference next year. So if we stay in the European Union, we want to pass a motion for extensive search and rescue operations in the European Union to ensure that there are no more corpses being washed up on the shores of Southern Europe. It's unacceptable, and we're going to stop it.
I'll just add to Aaron's description of a humane policy for the Mediterranean and beyond, some news. Do you know that the mayor of Palermo in Sicily, who's a friend and a comrade of DiEM25, our Democracy in Europe movement, every time there is a boat of refugees that arrives in Sicily, he makes a point of being there to welcome them and to hand out municipal identity cards that allow them full access to all the public services of the municipality of Palermo. Now, how about just, generalizing that policy? And I will finish with some news, more news, if you want. In January, DiEM25 and the Labour Party, we are going to have a conference in Brussels that will be an extension of the International Social Forum that we had last July in London. And the whole point is to put together, based on the experience that we've had in creating a transnational council and European Green New Deal as DiEM25, to take this further, not just to North Africa and the Middle East, but to create an international Green New Deal with comrades and organizations and movements and municipalities and trade unions from India, from Africa, from Asia, from Latin America. We have, you know, Lula supporting this and Haddad from Brazil. We have the president of Mexico supporting this. We have the Democratic Socialists of the United States supporting this. So we're going to take this further. John McDonnell and I have had this discussion yesterday. This is, you know, if you want a newsflash for your podcast, we are going to pursue this very energetically, and we are going to pursue it a lot more efficiently if you elect a Corbyn government.
We have one final question, which is not from the audience. It's from the Navarra Media backstage crew, who are amazing. Give them a big round of applause, actually. Which is that, in honour of your advice to Jeremy Corbyn, which is play really fucking hard when he's in negotiations with the EU, these are the Fug Life glasses. Which is going to make a nice thumbnail for this show. Yes, na-na-na-na-na. Okay. Thank you, Aaron Bastani.
Pleasure.
You've been a fabulous last-minute replacement. You can always pull it out of the bag.
That's good to hear. Well, I was meant to. They said, "Look, Aaron, we're going to need some dissensus. So just kind of try and ventriloquise the sorts of things that, you know, Len would have said." And I think I probably didn't do that. Sadly, maybe I did. I mean, I'm not going to.
You know what? You're our first choice, second choice.
Thank you.
I mean, that is true. I did go to you first. Yanis Varoufakis, thank you so much for joining us this evening. It's been an honour. And Ash Sarkar, no evening discussing left strategy is complete without your presence and insight. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. And as ever, thank you to our YouTube audience. Thank you to the latest TV bar for hosting us. And thank you for everyone who has come here this evening and your fabulous questions. And to the TWT volunteers, the World Transform volunteers. Every year they pull it off. Incredibly committed bunch of people, just like the team in Navarra Media. I don't know, I should maybe do a money shout out for TWT, but it's not in my script. But what is in my script is you're watching Navarra Media and Tisky Sauer. Which is only possible because of your kind support. If you are already a supporter, thank you very much. If not, please go to support.navarramedia.com and donate the equivalent of 1 hour's wage a month. In part, so we can move studio before a general election. That is the plan. In any case, good evening on YouTube. Good evening to everyone who is here. Have a wonderful evening. We'll see you tomorrow with Paul Mason, Grace Blakely, and David Lammy to discuss the future of Labour.